Time to take a look at your pet's health. Hi, Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And if you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be back on this beautiful day.
Wow, what a gorgeous day out there.
I know. And, you know, we were just talking about your boat, which you
yes.
store in my garage.
Yes.
And you've been wanting to pick it up. And unfortunately, I'm a big gardener and I had 10 yards of mulch, my first of probably at least another 10 yards, delivered and dumped not quite where I wanted it to be dumped, which blocked access to my back garage where your boat is. And so it got me thinking about mulch because I've been moving it day and night trying to get it so you can get your boat out. One kind of mulch, if you have pets, and I think this has probably come up on the show before, is it's even though it smells nice and it looks beautiful, no cocoa bean mulch.
Right.
Very toxic. And I can't tell you how many dogs like to sample it and eat it because it smells good. It smells like chocolate. And there's enough of the active ingredient in there, the stimulant, that it can make a dog toxic. So if you have pets, avoid that mulch and go with what I'm using, which is just like shredded oak or whatever. So, yeah.
I use something, what is it? It's not shredded oak. It's something else. Redwood, I think.
Redwood,
Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm staying away from. I had the cocoa bean 1 year, and I kind of liked it, but frankly, it molds on you.
It does it? Oh, okay. Well, see, I didn't know that, but it tastes good according to most dogs that eat it. So,
okay. Well, Doris in Shawnee County has a question for you, so let's go right there to Doris. Hi, Doris.
I'm an avid gardener, and I'm trying to protect my neighbor's cats. I have 2 or 3. Cats that patrol my garden regularly. I have a lot of trouble with voles, and other years I have always poisoned them. If I would poison them, would they possibly pick up a dead vole and poison themselves?
Yes, because, you know, when your cats eat the vole, if the toxin is still in their system in the stomach, and it depends on what you're using, definitely could cause a problem for the cat. I'm surprised the cats aren't being a good vole catcher for you if they're coming over. But, you can try, traps and things like that. But I'd really try to avoid putting any toxins out, especially if you've got cats that are avid hunters.
I think you can catch them with mouse traps.
Yes. I mean, that's what, like, live traps. Or not live traps, but, you know, just trapping systems. Yeah.
Yeah, mouse traps will do
rather
it.
Than toxins.
Yep. Yep. There you have it, Doris. Thanks for calling. Joan and Madison, on to you now. Hi, Joan.
Hi. We have 2 cats. They are orange tabby litter mates, females. They're almost 8. They're completely indoor cats. And one of them has terrible eyesight. Now, I know that cats do not have good eyesight, but hers is really bad. She bumps into doors. She bumps into table legs. Her sister was sitting in the middle of the floor one day, and she fell over her sister. And,
wow.
It may be our perception, but it seems to be getting a little bit worse. She's healthy in every other way. Our vet looked at her eyes and couldn't see anything. This was a couple of months ago. But I guess the question is this abnormal, and is there such a thing as a kitty ophthalmologist?
Oh, good questions.
What should we do?
Yeah. Well, you know, most veterinarians do look at eyes, and it's something that, I mean, if you were to come in and ask me what could be wrong with my cat, and no, blindness is not normal. And so if your cat is bumping into things, whether she's mentally disoriented or actually visually impaired, that would be something to be trying to evaluate. And so going through a full neurologic exam to make sure that she knows that where her feet are in space and that she's, you know, the rest of her cranial nerves and so on are all functioning normally. Then looking at the eyes, and we start with, first of all, just looking at the cornea, the surface of the eye. There's a couple of infections that cats get that can affect the cornea, and I would be thinking that your veterinarian would have picked this up because it would be very obvious, and if you had some corneal scarring. Cats can get cataracts, but unlike humans and dogs, removing the cataract is not an option for cats just because of their anatomy. They can't have the bad lens removed without having, you know, serious complications with their vision. And then we start looking at, is there a retinal problem? So going back further in the eye. And that's where having perhaps an ophthalmologist have a look would be in order. And yes, we're a state that's been blessed with several board-certified ophthalmologists. We've got two clinics, not only the vet school in Madison, but also another private ophthalmologist here in Madison. Up in the Fox Valley area, there's an ophthalmologist, and even over in the Milwaukee area. So we've got lots of people around. Just ask your veterinarian where they would like to refer you, and I'm sure that your kitty, they can get to the bottom of it and try to figure out what's going on.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Kathy in Gurnee, Illinois, who says, even though we try to keep the dogs from dining out at the litter box, it happens. My question is, what are the dangers of a dog ingesting clumping litters? Can this cause a blockage?
Yeah, a good question. Well, kitty fritters, it's one of those things. You got a cat, you got a dog, you got to keep that litter box scooped. And, you know, there are some of those automatic litter boxes that automatically run the sifter through it once the cat gets out. But a lot of cats are afraid of those. So don't just run out and get one of those to keep your dog from getting into it. Sometimes, I mean, I'm not answering the question, but just getting to the, you know, having the litter box in a spot that the cat has easy access to, but the dog doesn't. So putting up a baby gate, a cat door that the cat can go through easily. Those are all helpful things. And it's hard to train your dog. I can't tell you how often I would, when I had basset hounds, you know, go to bed and there'd be kitty litter on my pillow. So I know exactly what they dined
what they
on. Yes. During the day while I was at work. The scoopable cat litter has been falsely blamed for causing, you know, lots of serious problems, especially in young cats. And they'd have to eat about 2 tablespoons of litter to cause, in a little kitten, to cause any trouble. Oh. Most of the clay that's used in scoopable cat litter is the same type of clay that's actually used in medicinal products for solving diarrhea issues. It's what's called adipugite clay, which is what you'll find if you're, you know, buying kale pectate or something. So that's what's in there, is actually clay that's been liquefied. So it's something that, you know, obviously if your dog is, you know, dining frequently, could potentially cause maybe some binding and maybe a little GI upset, but you're probably not going to form cement balls in your dog's intestinal tract. What I'd be more concerned about is dental disease. And if you've got a dog that likes to dine in the litter box, brush those teeth every day, not only for the dog's health, but also, you know, most dogs like to kiss their owners. And
yes.
Ooh. I wouldn't want that after they've dined in the litter box. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned teeth, and we had Mary from Cedarburg email us and wonder what you could tell her about the vaccine out now to stop or prevent tooth decay in dogs. Sounds too good to be true, but my vet seems to be pushing it. My 5-year-old terrier dachshund mix has great teeth, hasn't needed a cleaning yet. I'll be listening at work. Thanks.
There we go. Well, the vaccine is actually called Porphyromonas vaccine. And I'm first of all going to just correct the emailer a little bit. Dogs rarely ever get cavities. There's an actual bacteria that we have in our mouth that the action of the bacteria on sugars and so on creates acids, which destroys our enamel. We don't see that bacteria in dogs' mouths very often. What we do see dogs running into troubles with is periodontal disease. And the number one bacteria that causes bone loss and the changes in the gum tissue and so on that holds the tooth in place is this bacteria called Porphyromonas.
Okay.
And so we have a vaccine available now for that. And I think, you know, do I push it for my clients? I let the dentist decide who's going to be a good candidate for it. A lot of times the little dogs that have, you know, a crowded mouth and, you know, dental disease that they want to try to stop after a good cleaning, that's the case that they start using the Porphyromonas vaccine. What I've seen with it is it's one of the few vaccines that I have to dispense an anti-inflammatory with it. It's painful.
Oh, boy.
Most dogs are going to be 24 hours reacting very uncomfortably from it. And I'm just hesitant to just pop it into everybody. But if it's a little dog with a history of dental disease and we want to help try to stop it, I think that's a great use for it.
Sue in Bailey's Harbor has a question for you. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a large Bernese Mountain Dog. She just turned a year old. And after we walk for maybe 5-6 blocks, she starts to limp.
Mm-hmm.
My vet seems to think she will outgrow it, that it's some sort of condition that's peculiar to large breed dogs. But it does concern us. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, there's only like one condition that we're going to see that dogs will kind of outgrow, and that's called panosteitis, where they actually get inflammation of their bones, and that doesn't happen with exercise. They're going to wake up with it, and it's going to be constant throughout the day, and it's something that will disappear over time. Most likely what I get concerned about in a large breed dog with a forelimb lameness, and it's front leg, right, that's causing the problem?
Right, her left front leg.
Left front leg. There's between the shoulder and the elbow, there's a lot of problems that can go on. We do see issues with little cartilage flaps occurring and sometimes little fragments of bone floating around in the joint, especially in the elbow. And I know at the vet school, one of the things that the orthopedic surgeons have been doing more often, because these can be difficult joints in a large dog because of the way they're configured to get a good shot of the joint with an x-ray, they've been doing CT scans of the joints, especially the elbow, and getting very good results for diagnosing what the problem is. Rather than let this go, she's young. If she has something orthopedically wrong, like a bone fragment or something, the longer you let it go, the more chance of permanent arthritic change occurring in that joint. And this would be one case where I'd probably disagree with your veterinarian and say she's going to outgrow it and say, let's get it looked at. And you may want to ask for a referral to an orthopedic surgeon, and be thinking about, you know, having a CT scan done of those joints. Just seems to be after, I mean, I just had my first patient go through that, and it was like amazing. The plain films versus the CT, you could see the problem. The dog's up and walking now and doing fine. In fact, it was a Swiss Mountain dog, a relative of your dog. So they just had that done. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Speaking of trips to the vet, here's an email from, let's see, Kathleen, who's in Indianapolis, living there for now, and listening to us on a live stream. So
there
that's great online.
Yeah.
She wonders if you have any advice for making a vet visit easier for a dog with a low pain threshold. She has a 200-pound rescue English Mastiff who dreads his annual visit with a heartworm test and vaccination, starts shedding immediately, so we know he's fearful, and we must muzzle him because he's not very cooperative, even for simple things like a blood draw. Stressful for us, the vet techs, and our dog, Ulysses. Is there anything we can do to make it easier?
You know, and this is the kind of thing that if an owner is willing to put the time in, multiple visits to the vet, whether nothing bad is being done, where they maybe just come into the parking lot, then come into the waiting room, and people are there giving the dogs treats and working with the dog that way, would be very, very helpful. So it's not always, I come to the veterinary clinic and bad things happen. It's I come there and it's like going to the dog park. Oh boy, I get treats, I get to play, I love this place. The other thing she can work on is if there's certain parts of the dog's body that the dog doesn't really like to have touched, desensitize the dog to touch, such as handling their feet. Picking up their foot to be able to get a blood sample is a problem for the dog, then she can work at home with, you know, using clicker training where she's touching the foot and the dog's getting rewarded and given, you know, something wonderful to eat, whatever the dog's favorite thing is. And it could be bits of chicken or freeze-dried liver or whatever. There's a remote training device that I just saw demonstrated that's called the Manners Minder, and it's made by a veterinarian that specializes in behavior named Cynthia Yin out in California, and it's marketed through a group called Premier Pets. And what she was looking at using it for, and you may want to go onto her website, and I think it's Cynthia Yin is her name, and I don't know what her website is, but she talks about how to use it effectively, especially for things like dogs that don't like to be groomed, dogs don't like to have their nails trimmed, and it's a very unique little food dispensing device that operates with a tone and a remote device that the owner holds, and a nice way of being able to, you know, use the kind of the clicker training type training, but a little bit easier for someone that's not fast on the draw.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk today, give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Barb in Chippewa Falls next. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about a 5-year-old male neutered cat that adopted us. It's an outside cat. We live out in kind of out in the country, so it's very much outside. My problem is that about 2 years ago, I think, and I let it go too long, it started chewing up the deck. I mean, just scratching the spindle down to not much.
Yeah.
And more than a year ago, where it used to meow to let us know it was interested in going outside, and we would let it outside right away, it has now started on the door frames in the house. Incredibly annoying.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had some suggestions about, I would prefer to change the behavior than to battle with this thing for cutting the nails, which are very, very sharp.
Yeah, yeah. And being, you know, an indoor-outdoor cat probably needs its claws for defense as well.
Yeah.
But what your cat is doing is like the normal marking behavior. And it's you know, cats will use, most cats like to use a scratching post when they're strictly indoors. But some cats have a preference for certain surfaces. And it sounds like your cat likes wood if it's gone after one of the spindles on your deck. What you can consider doing is if that spindle is something that you can, you know, take out and maybe mount on something else, it would be an appropriate spot since it's got his scent as well as a visual cue that he lives there. And that's the whole reason why cats scratch. It's not just to hone their claws and get them nice and sharp. They're leaving their scent behind, and they're also leaving a visual mark so that any other cats that come by can say, ah, you know, he lives there. And so, you know, you don't get rid of that spindle, but try to put it in the similar area, and maybe he will just direct it right to that. Or you could find something else, like a log or something that you may be able to put in that spot, like a, you know, a tall, like a scratching post that's commercially available, or you can even mount a, you know, a good, nice, tall, sturdy log to something that would give him something that he can scratch, and then take that spindle that he's already scratched on and cover it up with something where he can't see it or smell it, like bubble wrap, and that may help a little bit too. When it comes to scratching at your woodwork, well, one, it gets attention. It gets you running to the door to let him out. It's also an area that he probably wants to mark, so it may be similar to what he's doing outside. You may want to look at either putting a cat door in that will allow him access in and out on his own. Problem is, it also allows wildlife to come in and anything he wants to bring in with him, dead mice and so on. So you've got that as a disadvantage. Again, putting a scratching post there, if he's doing it just for scratching, right in that spot, even though it may be inconvenient for you, obviously he likes that area. So something made out of wood that's nice, tall, and sturdy, and then cover up the woodwork. And for inside use, there's a product called Sticky Paws, which is like double stick carpet tape, very, very tacky, and it's almost like flypaper for cats. They don't like the feel of it, and you can stick it onto your woodwork or on your upholstery, and it may keep him from wanting to go after that area. But don't just try to stop it. You need to redirect it to something more appropriate.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling.
Yes, just one more follow-up.
Sure.
Okay, that would be multiple posts and spindles on the deck. Are, should I use that sticky stuff on those that I want to keep them away from, just cover it?
Well, the problem with using that sticky paws outdoors is it's going to be exposed to the weather.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and so that's why I was thinking something like bubble wrap or something
Okay.
All right, good luck. Thanks again, Barb, for calling. And Debbie in Whitewater up next. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there. See, I have an 11-year-old English Springer Spaniel who's in excellent health, but I'm hoping that you can maybe provide some avenues because my vet and I are kind of puzzled. We've been battling something since January. He literally, boom, one day was just very lethargic. He had a fever. He was shivering. He didn't really want to eat, and so I took him in and we did some blood work, which was normal. And my vet put him on clindamycin, and we talked about Lyme disease. And the clindamycin perked him up a bit, but not much. So we decided to go ahead and treat him for Lyme. And that just, the doxycycline just made him into a new dog.
Okay.
He was on doxycycline for about a month. And when we took him off of it, very quickly we had the same cycle again. So I went back to the vet, and we got more doxycycline, and he just, you know, completely is a new dog. But now he's showing some signs of similar to what he showed before, where he's kind of roachy in the back, and if you touch his right flank, he yelps. And, you know, I just don't really know where to go from here. My vet suggested perhaps he had some rheumatoid arthritis going on because his rickettsial test came back negative.
Okay. Yeah, there. You know, I was going to say getting tick titers done, and there are a number of different tick-borne diseases that we see in Wisconsin, including things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. No spots, no Rocky Mountains, but we have it here. And things like anaplasma. There's another Ehrlichia canis that dogs can get as well. And so it's not just Lyme disease. There's a number of different things that we can run into troubles with. So, you know, doing a good, you know, tick check would be definitely indicated. If he's got focal pain in his back, I'd also be looking at, you know, perhaps this would be a spot that needs to be x-rayed and looked at. I would hope that your veterinarian, because we'll sometimes even see kidney pain refer to the back as well, that they're doing a, you know, complete, you know, database and getting urine and a CBC and chemistries and so on. And, you know, not just basing it on tick titers, but looking at the dog's whole body. And, you know, and so it's, I think it's time to go back to the drawing board again, rather than just throwing antibiotics. Yes, the dog needs something, but it sounds like your dog's in a lot of pain, and even pain management may need to be added to the protocol as well. And I don't know if your veterinarian has been addressing the pain, but using either anti-inflammatories if his kidneys and liver can work are working fine, which is another reason why we'd want to get lab work, or something like tramadol, which is a centrally acting pain medication. So I'm not really helping you a whole lot, except it sounds like your dog needs a little bit more intensive workup.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Debbie. Patricia and Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I have two kitties, Tabby, 11 years old, and an orange kitty, 10. And we are going to be going to London, England next year with my husband. Mm-hmm. We're going to be there for a whole year. First, we wanted to bring him with us, but we couldn't because of the quarantine rules. We mm-hmm. just didn't yeah. make it. Now, this is the question. What would be better for my kitties so they're not so traumatized when we're gone? Would it be better that they stay in our house with renters that are willing to take care of them? Or would it be better for them to go, for instance, with my son to his apartment, and he would take care of them in a different environment, but with a person that they really know?
Oh, good questions. But, yeah. You know, back to your quarantine issue, it's much easier to get into England and into the United Kingdom now, as long as you plan ahead of time. And it sounds like, you know, if you're going next year, you have enough time right now. I'm not sure. It's a six-month quarantine period that occurs in this country. And what we do is the pet is obviously vaccinated for rabies, microchipped and vaccinated for rabies. And then if they're current on the rabies vaccine, we draw a blood sample for what's called a rabies titer, which is a measure of their immune status for against rabies. That gets sent off to a lab, I believe it's in Kansas. And from the day that that blood sample's taken, the timer starts. And so they have, instead of doing 6 months in lockdown over there, they're doing 6 months over here. And it's not really quarantine. They're not locked up. They're just at home, you know, current on the rabies vaccination. And then 24 to 48 hours before you leave to go over there, you have an appointment with the federal vet. You have an appointment with an accredited vet like myself or probably your veterinarian. They're treated for ticks and examined. Health certificate is issued and you're off, and they can go over there and live with you for the whole year if that's what you want
right.
to do.
We wanted to do that. We are going in the fall. I should have said that.
Okay, so you don't have enough time.
And we found out it was 5 months in total before we go.
Right.
Yeah, so you don't have enough time.
That's why we couldn't do that.
Yeah, you
would have loved to bring him with us.
Yeah, you need at least 6 months. And I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. If your cats travel well and adjust to new environments, maybe you trust your son better to provide them with the care that they need. If you've got renters that are there that you know that like cats and are able to keep the litter boxes clean and are willing to feed them and provide them with the medical care that they need, I think either option would be open, and it kind of depends on your cats. You know, I have three cats at home, and boy, they would rather stay at home. The thought of having them move to a new environment would be very traumatic for them. So I'd probably keep them there, hoping that they would get provided with the care that they need. So mm-hmm. kind of look at your cats and go from there.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, and good luck on your trip. Sonia in Chippewa Falls, on to you now. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, thanks. I have a couple questions. I have a yellow lab who's going to be 6 this summer, and I'm kind of new to dog ownership, so I don't know a whole lot about what's normal and what isn't.
Uh-huh.
But the first question is, she often has very loose stools, almost diarrhea-like. In fact, yesterday she had one that was basically watery. And she eats the same food. It's the same food she got at her prior owners. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what's causing this problem. I've been feeding her pumpkin occasionally, which is supposed to help.
Yeah. How often does she do this?
You know, it's like we'll have one day where it's nice and firm, and then the next day she'll start out firm and get looser, you know, during the day, and it gets bad. So I feel like every other day.
Wow. Yeah, that's not normal. And rather than just throwing pumpkin, which is a source of fiber, at her, I think it would be time to, first of all, contact the previous owner and find out if this has been worked up. And if it hasn't, you know, you're going to need to find a veterinarian that's willing to start from square one. Bring in a fresh stool sample with you. Don't be surprised if they want to even collect some via rectal. They may want to do a little bit of lab work to make sure that her protein levels are fine and that there's nothing else going on with her. Come prepared with, you know, full diet disclosure, including treats and so on, and that would include even things like rawhide. And, you know, you take it from there. By far, one of the number one reasons why we see, you know, chronic diarrhea in pets is parasites. And, you know, and so sometimes even if we do get a negative stool sample, be prepared. Your veterinarian may say, you know what, we're still going to go through a thorough parasite treatment, which is usually using a drug called fenbendazole or Panacure. That's the number one drug that a lot of veterinarians like to grab that covers most of the intestinal parasites that dogs get. But this is not typical, absolutely not typical. And so time to get this worked up.
Okay. My second quick question is, she's an obsessive paw licker, and I don't know if that's really an issue or if I should just let her do it. I mean,
yeah. Well, a lot of Labrador Retrievers are also allergic, and that may be one of the things that's causing her to have her diarrhea, is if she's got a dietary intolerance to some type of protein or whatever, and that can be causing her chronic diarrhea. And, you know, but it's also possible she's licking her feet because they're itchy. So when she's at the clinic, the feet need to be looked at, and that's between the toes and actually flipping the feet over.
The vet just did that.
And so I'd be doing some skin scrapings and maybe what I call a scotch tape prep, and look under the microscope for bacteria and yeast. This is not something you're going to find with the naked eye. You need to look at it with the microscope. So I hope that the veterinarian did that to make sure that there's nothing going on. If there isn't an infection, it's possible that it's still allergies. And so trying a topical anti-inflammatory, there's a spray called Genesis spray that works very well that you can just use locally on the feet. If that isn't working, then we may be looking at, is this just some type of a compulsive disorder that the dog is doing it just because it's like a kid sucking their thumb, you know,
right.
Makes them feel more comfortable. But I'd rule out medical problems first because by far they're more common.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Sarah and DePere up next. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I'm actually driving. I'm almost in Madison.
Oh.
I have a question about my Maltese and Shih Tzu mix. He just turned 11. I'm just heartsick about this. He has congestive heart failure.
Okay.
Oh. Before he went on a new medicine called Zetmedin, he would start to cough, and at times he would be unable to breathe, I think, and he would kind of go down, sort of lose his ability to stand, and then he would kind of tip over on his side and let out this sort of screaming noise.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I don't know if that was, like, I don't know if that was a heart thing or if he was having a seizure.
Mm-hmm. It could be either. You know, it's not, the drug that your dog is on right now, Pimobendan, is kind of a godsend for us as we're for treating dogs that have heart failure. But there's other drugs that get thrown in there as well. And I am not a cardiologist and you know, keeping up with all the new drugs and so on, I have, they all kind of blend in my head. But I'm not sure if you have worked with a veterinary cardiologist, but having an ECG done, I think, would be indicated to make sure that he's got normal complexes, that he's not running into troubles with dropping beets that is causing him to faint and, you know, or have seizures or whatever he may be doing, having an ultrasound or an echocardiogram done on his heart to see. Yeah, so you've been through all of that as well. Yeah, you know, checking his blood pressure, making sure that that's normal, and, you know, special diets and so on are indicated as well. But, yeah, it's these are tough cases. I had a dog that died of heart failure, and this is before Pimobendan came on the market. And it's not a fun thing to watch a dog go through. But when it gets to the point where they start having, like, fluid building up in their lungs, they often need to be on Lasix to help eliminate extra body fluid, which is a diuretic. So, you know, it sounds like all this stuff's being done. So,
He is on Lasix and also... And Enalapril, I think it is.
Enalapril, yeah.
Enalapril. He was on that initially, but the vetmedin has really decreased the coughing a lot.
Good. And part of this problem, too, may be that not only does he have heart disease, but being a small breed dog, they're also very prone to collapsing trachea.
Right.
Their windpipe is much weaker instead of having nice firm cartilage rings. And so when the heart enlarges, it starts pushing on the airways, and that can be, causing more of a coughing problem as well for him.
Initially, we thought it was that, but then it became apparent that it was a cardiac issue.
Yeah.
May I ask another question?
Yeah.
His nose seems to be running all the time, and during the night he seems uncomfortable because of his nose running. He kind of tries to blow the water, he tries to blow that out, and then he also, like the last caller, is obsessively licking his front one paw.
It's
very red colored.
The red color is because in saliva there's a chemical called porphyrins, and when the porphyrins react to light, they turn that rusty brown color. And you've probably seen white dogs with the tear staining on their face as well. Tears have the same chemical, and so that just tells us that he's licking his foot. I would be very concerned, being an 11-year-old dog, what his shape his teeth are in as well, because some of these dogs that have a nasal discharge and so on, it's because they have dental problems where the tooth roots are sitting up next to the nasal passages and causing inflammation secondary into the nose. And so does he have dental disease as well?
He actually has very few teeth left.
Okay.
About a year ago, he had to have dental surgery, and I think he probably has about three teeth left.
Okay. So, you know, whether that's those last three teeth are causing him any troubles, you could have those evaluated. Sometimes we find that these older patients do well on pulse therapy antibiotics if they're not suitable for anesthesia and dentistry, and that might be, again, something else to bring up with your veterinarian.
And good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Good luck with your animal there, your pet. Thank you, Sarah. Tracy in Two Rivers will give you a chance now. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I have a 13-week-old male Old English sheepdog pup who thus far only has one testicle.
Oh.
Yeah. He's a show-quality pup. He was actually the pick of the litter, but the breeder basically gave him to me because the testicle isn't down.
Mm-hmm.
What are the odds that this thing will come down?
Slim.
Her reproductive vet and my vet both said that the testicle is not retained up in the body. It's just kind of right there, just not there.
Not there, not in his scrotum. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably slim. It's possible. I usually give them the benefit of the doubt until about 6 months of age. And I have been surprised a couple of times in my career. But this is a birth defect. It's also a defect that will not allow him to be shown, if that's what you were planning on doing with him. It will affect his fertility to some degree. And he may still be able to get another dog pregnant because he has one active testicle. But the other one is not going to be producing sperm. If you were to neuter him and just remove the one that is visible, the other one will still remain virile, and he will still be producing testosterone. So if you do plan on neutering him, if at 6 months it's not descended into the scrotum, make sure that they do take both testicles. I don't know of any vet that wouldn't, but they both of them need to be removed, even if it may mean a fishing trip to find the other one.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't real concerned about the, you know, having him neutered or having it not taken out. I wanted to wait until he was about 2 years old to have him neutered anyway, so.
Yeah. Why did you want to wait till two?
I wanted to get some more bone growth in him.
Okay.
I wanted him to have all of those secondary sexual characteristics.
Okay.
Nice bone growth and, you know,
Yeah, and just to you know, play devil's advocate, remember, if you let him wait that long, he's going to develop not only the secondary physical sex characteristics, but also the behavior things as well, such as fighting with other boy dogs and roaming and leg lifting and more humping and all those things. So just be prepared, you know, there's a trade-off.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy, for your call as well. Perry and Conover, on to you now. Hi.
Good morning. I also have an 11-year-old yellow lab who has some open ulcers in her back. We have had her checked for cancer. That's been ruled out. We've checked for diabetes with a dipstick. That's been ruled out. They put her on cefixime twice, 500 milligrams, two times a day. And where it helped the wounds from oozing so much, it has not healed up the two ulcers that originally started on her back. But now I've noticed these ulcers have spread onto her stomach area. She's got one on her hind leg.
Have they been biopsied?
They took some sample of it to see if it was cancer.
How did they do that?
With a needle.
With a needle.
Yes.
You may want to look at actually having an excisional biopsy. Being an 11-year-old dog, a few things that I'd be worried about. Number one, you know, if you do want to actually rule out cancer, you can, you know, sometimes a needle aspirate may help, but if they're really suspicious of that, sometimes actually taking a punch biopsy, taking a piece out in formalin and looking at it, because needle biopsy where you're just collecting a few cells may or may not be helpful. How much does your dog weigh by chance?
88 pounds.
Okay. Your dog is getting less than half the amount of cefalexin she needs, okay? If she's 88 pounds, that means she's 40 kilograms. She needs about 2,400 milligrams per day. So I'd be at least giving double, if not triple, what she's currently getting right now.
Well, she's off of it now. She's
okay.
Off of it for 3 weeks. Again, they just gave it to her for 1 month, both two separate times.
Yeah, and that if they used it at that dose, that's an inappropriate dose. That's not the right dose for a dog her size. So it could be that she, if she does have an infection there, it just wasn't treated appropriately. You also may, if they're also worried about infection, and they're thinking, let's treat her with antibiotics, we are seeing more and more cases of MRSA and MRSI, methicillin-resistant staph infections, either the dog version, intermedius, or the human version, aureus. And so when we have infections that aren't clearing up, that are being treated with the appropriate antibiotic, you know, we've you know, looked at cytology, and yeah, there's bacteria there.
Right.
We want to treat. We will do a culture, and you'd be surprised how many dogs we're seeing this in. I'd also be making sure that they're ruling out other things like, you know, does she have any external parasites? Sometimes older dogs will develop a parasite called Demodex, which is a mite that normally lives on dogs in very low levels, but when their immune system starts to fail, they invade and will start to spread and cause secondary infections too. So it sounds pretty complicated,
yeah.
and you've been, it sounds like you've been working on this for a while, and I sound like a broken record of going to a specialist, but you know, rather than calling me, I think you need to talk to a veterinary dermatologist.
Yeah. Okay.
And get all your records and see what's going on. But or go back to your vet and say, let's get her on the appropriate antibiotic if you think that's the route that we need to go.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. Sandy, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a question about your pet's health, I hope you do, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Marcia in Caledonia up next. Marcia, hi to you.
Fine. I have a question about a 3-year-old chocolate lab. The dog belongs to our son and his wife. The dog developed conjunctivitis in her eye, and they were worried about her, so they brought her into the vet yesterday. At 3 o'clock, they gave her a sedative so the doctor could make a better diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Okay. They brought her home last night, and that's when the strangeness started. She was very restless. She couldn't sit down. She'd just walk and walk and walk. It got to the point at around 1 o'clock in the morning where she was staggering.
Hmm.
She defecated all over the house, which is she never has done that since she was a little puppy.
Yeah.
And And then she started throwing up. My daughter-in-law called me. I said, get her to the vet. I think there's a reaction to the sedative.
Yeah, yeah.
She did not eat.
Yeah.
And because the vet said, I think she ate something.
Yeah.
She did not eat. Is this normal? Or, I mean, I don't even know what to ask.
Except
how can we fix her?
Yeah. Sometimes dogs that are sedated will have kind of some euphoria or dysphoria or whatever you want to call it, where they'll be not themselves for a period of time, which is why when we go in and have procedures done, they always say have somebody else drive you home, have somebody else stay with you, operate heavy equipment, don't go to work and so on. And so I'd love to know what they used and whether it was a reversible sedation. What I get really concerned about when a dog is acting that usually when they're sedated, they just want to lay there and sleep. And the fact that she was up and acting like she was pretty uncomfortable, pacing and then defecating and not wanting to eat. Sometimes when we've sedated a dog and if they've kind of flopped around a little bit, I worry that maybe she's bloating, I wonder if her belly was getting bigger, whether she was uncomfortable.
They checked for that. In fact, the vet said, well, maybe we should do x-ray of her abdomen.
Yeah.
And he felt of her abdomen, and it was not bloated.
Okay, so good. Well, I'm glad they looked into that, because that's definitely a life-threatening emergency. And this may just be a cocktail that this particular dog, is she back to normal now?
No, we don't know for sure. She's at the vet. We left her there.
Okay.
But I'm thinking they want to clean her teeth in about a month's time. We've got an appointment set up.
Yeah.
And if they use, then they'll do a general. But she was not quite right after the last time she had her teeth cleaned, which is about a year ago.
Yeah, so she may just be very intolerant of different anesthetics. And this would be something where looking at her history, and hopefully all the records are there of what drugs and what dosage she's had. And, you know, this, it sounds like she's maybe having an issue with, you know, certain types of drugs that she can't tolerate. We do know that there's just like in people, there's some humans that depending on the drugs that are used, you can end up with what's called malignant hyperthermia, where your temperature goes up. Be curious what her temperature is and whether
it was normal.
It was normal. Oh, see, all these things. I'm just being shot down.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with your dog, but this is just a good case where a veterinarian has to keep good medical records and an owner needs to be prepared when they're taking a dog home the same day of a procedure that they may not be quite themselves. And it sounds like this is the extreme, and I'm glad she's being cared for, and hopefully it's nothing serious.
Yeah.
I really don't know what's going on right now.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Marcia. We take some more calls. Boy, those are always hard, aren't they, when you have no idea?
I don't. I think I would love to have the veterinarian on the phone. If he's listening or she's listening, give us a call and give me a rundown as to what's going on, because I'm really worried about that dog.
Yeah. Thanks, Marcia. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I have a question about our 14-year-old kitty. She's highly opinionated and develops very strong prejudices.
Okay.
In the food area. We give her nutritional supplements. We've been doing this for quite a few years that have greatly benefited her health and cleared up a skin condition that she had.
Mm-hmm.
And she will only eat the... We mix them up. What we do is we blend up a chunk light tuna and a little bit of shrimp, and then freeze it in an ice cube tray, and we mix the supplements up in one of the cubes. And we have tried switching to using beef, and we've tried switching to using turkey, and she just turns her nose up and leaves the room. And she will only eat them out of the tuna and shrimp. Generally, her health seems to be excellent. I have noticed that fairly frequently when she starts to either lick off the spoon or lick out of the bowl when she's eating her treat, that she'll have one of her forelegs will jerk.
Huh.
It's not always. And my concern here is the possible danger of mercury poisoning from her eating tuna. My husband has researched it, and we're using the type of tuna that for humans, they say you can eat more times a week than any other kind of tuna.
Now, does she eat anything else besides this? Or,
yes.
Okay, what else is she eating besides? So the tuna is just to get the supplement. And what is the supplement that you're giving her?
Well, we're actually giving her we're giving her a pet probiotic.
Okay.
And nutritional yeast.
Okay.
And a proprietary product called Ambritose, which is a glyconutritional supplement.
Okay.
And Vitalo and Sport, which is a has Dioscorea and orchic substances.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with that last one, but
beef testicles.
Yeah. Okay. You know, so you're working with your veterinarian understands what's going on with all of that. And, you know, as long as she's getting a regular balanced diet and is not just eating, tuna, I mean, because that's an extremely unbalanced diet, even with the supplements that you're adding. So she needs to be eating something that is, a well-balanced, tested food.
We give her Wysong kibble.
Wysong kibble, good. Okay, so she is getting another type of food as well.
And then we also are giving her just a treat of a little piece of turkey, which she loves the turkey by itself.
Okay. So it may just be that she's one of these fussy kitties, but, that's pretty normal. I really don't think that this is probably an issue with mercury poisoning. It's possible. I mean, sometimes we do see cats developing seizure disorders, and the most common reason for an older cat that's 14 would be a benign brain tumor that is called a meningioma, and they're quite common in cats as they get older. I would expect that if it was something like mercury poisoning, you'd be seeing personality change, you'd be seeing peripheral neuropathies, you'd be seeing all kinds of weirdness rather than just this intermittent little jerkiness. Another thing that could, which is very common, is arthritis. We sometimes don't even think about arthritis in cats because we're not taking them for walks. But if she's having to put her head down to eat, that could be, stressing that front leg a little bit, which is causing it to, shake and be a little uncomfortable for her. Perhaps try feeding her from one of those elevated platforms like they make usually for dogs, but cats do quite well with them as well. And that might be just a little more comfortable for her. Mm-hmm. That might be something to give a try.
I frequently have held the bowl up while she eats.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah. Okay. So, whether this is, if she's doing this jerking at other times rather than when she's just eating, then I'd be more concerned about a seizure disorder. But if it's only when she's eating, strange. And I'm not sure, again, getting a good orthopedic evaluation done on her and see if they can find anything that's causing her some discomfort.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, we're on to you. Hi, Paul.
Hello. And Sandy, you are a blessing to have on the air.
Well,
I've called you a few times before about my wonderful 15-year-old Chow Chow, and her. You helped me with her incontinence problem. Now,
good.
I got a couple of. I've been listening to the whole show, and I feel so badly for all these people that have dogs and cats that have really big issues.
Please have something simple.
What's your big issue?
Oh, good. What is your issue?
Like I say, my dog she's got really luxuriant long fur, and I want to give her a flea and tick bath. I don't have a real big problem with fleas and ticks where I live, although I did pick one off of her the other day.
Well, I can tell you right now, flea and tick bathing is not going to provide you with any residual effect. So the problem with using flea and tick shampoos is you're diluting them with water, you're putting them on the dog, they need to sit and be on contact for at least 10 minutes. And so for like little animals and things, they can get chilled. Then you have to rinse. And as soon as you rinse, the chemical's gone. Which is why we advocate using more of the topical products that are going to last longer, which is also receiving a lot of scrutiny from the EPA. The last count, there's over 500 different spot-on products that are available for owners to use on their pets. Some of them prescription, some not. And, you know, this would be something to talk to if you're worried about ticks, which I would be if you're finding them on your dog, be using something as a spot-on product rather than bathing your dog, because that's that thick hair coat, not going to dry very quickly. So.
Yeah, but, well, I'm not really, you know, she's a pretty weather-conditioned dog. I'm not, and I bathe her in the bathtub. This product is supposed to kill flea eggs. Well, like I say, we don't have a problem with fleas here, but mainly ticks, and it's good for 1 month. This is total vanity.
But is, you know, so I don't know of any shampoo that lasts for a month. There's spot-on products that last for a month, but no shampoos, because as soon as you rinse them off, the active ingredient's gone. So.
And we have to take a quick break. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, as we talk about your pet's health here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. And Dr. Sandy, we have Rick here emailing us, who has a four-month-old Brittany training for hunting. He was planning not to spay her for a potential breeding sometime in the future, but I'm concerned about her coming into heat during the hunting season. If this should happen, is it a bad idea to take her afield? How long does the heat cycle typically last?
Well, I don't know too many intact male dogs that would let a dog in heat go by and go after the game that they're supposed to be going for. So be prepared for, you know, her having a pack of boys running after her and potentially unwanted pregnancies. So, no, I would leave her at home and not have her out where she's going to be, you know, on her own and not under, you know, extremely close supervision. I don't think anybody else would appreciate that. But how long does a heat cycle last? It's a little variable. Usually we say from the first day they start having any vaginal discharge or bleeding. Remember, it's very different than humans. When they start bleeding, it's because you have estrogen levels rising. And it's when usually the discharge stops that they're the most fertile. So they typically ovulate about day 9 to 15, somewhere in that range. But there's a lot of variability and it can go longer, especially for a first heat cycle. So we tell people once they start showing signs of coming into heat, pretty well keep them under lock and key for about 21 days, and that will usually do it. So, yeah.
All right. Rebecca in Black Earth has a question for you. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I have a 9-year-old chocolate lab, and about 4.5 years ago, he had completely torn his CCL, and we took him to an orthopedic surgeon, and he ended up having it fixed with a plate and some screws.
Okay.
And at the time, the surgeon had said that in his other leg, his CCL was partially torn. So it was kind of inevitable that we would end up having to have that leg done as well. My concern is of course, now it's 4.5 years later. He's 9 years old. While the surgery was a success, it was a lot for him, and I'll say my husband and I as well, but mostly for him to go through that recovery.
Yeah.
Being so confined and restricted and being the lab that he is, just wanting to be around us constantly and not be restricted. And so I'm trying to weigh the option of, do I look to put him through surgery again with the recovery, or is there a way that I could manage the inflammation and the pain of his leg, and also to say his wrists and his forelimbs. He has arthritis there that inflames every once in a while, so he'll look at it. I just don't know what would be the best for him right now.
Yeah, you know, and it is a tough decision. I've been through it with my own dog, and I can tell you that that first month of having him crated and needing to be running home, and I live a half hour from here, I would be running home, letting him out, coming back to work, and, you know, and so I'd spend my lunch hour, literally the hour, in the car and, you know, 5 minutes at home doing a little physical therapy. And then going through all the physical therapy, I mean, it was a good 2 or 3 months before he was starting to get back to his normal activity. So, you know, I understand your concern, especially with summer coming up. But not repairing it, having that instability, it, the arthritis is just going to get worse. You're going to have increasing inflammation. He'll end up being, you know, worse off on that leg. But you've also got the dilemma of he's a 9-year-old dog. And this is not inexpensive surgery. You're looking at probably $3,000 to $4,000 for a TPLO, which is what it sounds like he had done before.
Yeah.
And then plus all the expenses of physical therapy and so on afterwards. So, you know, he's, you know, being a 9-year-old dog, what's his life expectancy? Well, I mean, I see labs living to be 14, 15 routinely these days. And so, you know, he's, you know, on the downhill side of his middle age years. So, you know, you've got that consideration too. If he's got arthritis in his front legs and you're giving him a bum hind leg, then he's going to be shifting his weight forward, which is going to make the arthritis in his front legs worse. So, yeah, you know, I think that if you read through the lines, between the lines, I think the 3 months or so that your life is going to be inconvenienced and he's going to be, you know, kept confined and so on is a good trade-off for several years of being pain-free and comfortable.
Okay. Yep.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. Thanks very much for calling. Sandy from Wausau emailed you, Dr. Sandy, and wonders if it's necessary to feed a nutritional supplement to my cats if they only eat dry food. They're currently on Science Diet. My male eats Oral Care and Nature's Best, and the female eats Nature's Best.
Okay. Both of them are well-balanced foods. If you look on the bags of the cat foods that she's using or your own bag, if you're sitting at home with your bag of cat food in front of you, you want to be looking for something that says meats or has been AFCO tested, American Association of Feed Control Officials, and it should say complete and balanced diet. By being complete and balanced, if your cat is healthy, has no digestive problems, has no other issues that require medical management or supplementation, I would not do it. It could make the diet unbalanced. And so there probably is no reason to be adding anything else in. But what I would recommend is sometimes variety is, you know, not only nice for the cat because they like variety sometimes, just like we do. Sometimes, you know, adding in even a little bit of canned food to their diet is going to increase their moisture intake. It's going to increase usually they're quite high in protein. They're not quite as processed. So, you know, that might be something to, if the cats will eat those, be something that you'd want to do. And I definitely recommend feeding both like a wet and dry rather than just dry by itself.
Okay. Let's go to Linda in Big Bend next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for the great show.
Sure.
I was calling to prevent the problem. I looked at some pups over the weekend where both the parents' hips rated as fair.
Okay.
I was wondering what you could tell me about hip dysplasia.
Okay. What breed was this?
Australian Shepherds.
Australian Shepherds. Okay. Why are they breeding them if they're only fair hips?
That's a good question.
And I think that what you brought up is the fact that being a purchaser of a dog, it is important that anybody that's going to be, you know, going, adding a pet to their life that's going to be there for a long time, you want to get the healthiest livestock that you can get. And that means it has to come from healthy livestock. And I, you know, so knowing which questions to ask, I mean, how many people with Australian Shepherds even know to ask, are the parents checked for hip dysplasia? And, you know, you want to be looking at other genetic diseases such as like Obama's new dog. A lot of the Portuguese water people screen their dogs for some storage diseases, a neurologic problem that happens to be fairly common with the breed as well. Some dogs will do eye evaluations. Others will get shoulder checks and elbow checks as well, thyroid checks. And so that's another thing that gets done for some breeding stock that has that as an issue. So going in with your list and not just saying, you know, if someone says, we've never seen it in our line before, you actually want to see that they've been tested for it. So this would be probably a breeding that I would say avoid because the chance of this offspring getting the disease. And what this is actually a developmental problem of the hips. The hip is a ball and socket joint. And when dogs develop hip dysplasia, instead of having a nice ball and socket where it fits nice and tightly, the socket part is more flattened, and so the ball part of the joint can roll around, and they're more prone to developing arthritis. And so you are taking a chance having a dog coming from genetic stock that may not have really good hips. But we also know that there's a lot of an environmental component as well to developing hip dysplasia. So you can have a dog that may have parents that have great hips, but if you feed them the wrong food, you let them get too heavy, you exercise them too hard that first year of life, that could also cause some problems with the hips as well. So lots of different factors, but the one thing that you can, you know, do something about besides, you know, what you can do at home is make sure you use have the right genes starting out for your puppy.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom in Rice Lake, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Good. My question, I have a Griffin, and periodically when he's resting, he almost like a gasp for air. It's like his nose, he makes kind of a snorting noise.
Okay. And I know Larry's going to say, Sandy can imitate that. Okay. And I'm probably going to have to do it on the air. I can do it. And I've done it before. And I don't know, I'll probably end up starting choking myself. If anyone does know what a Griffin is, they're the cutest little kind of squish-faced, fuzzy, they've got kind of like wiry hair. And they're just adorable little dogs. And me having bulldogs at home, I hear this all the time as well. In fact, my dog just did it last night. I believe it's probably what's called reverse sneezing. Absolutely nothing to do with the sneeze. Sneezing is, you know, rapidly expelling air out of your airways. This is actually sucking air in. And we think what's happening is the soft palate, the back of the roof of the mouth, is getting entrapped over the epiglottis. And so the dog is kind of inhaling and kind of choking on the back of their throat. And they make the sound. And let's see if I can do it. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. There we go. That was like not a pig imitation. But if they'll plant their front legs and they look like they're suffocating. If you can get your dog to swallow, sometimes rubbing their throat, just even picking them up will get them to expel air out of their chest. It's almost like doing a little bit of a Heimlich. If it's a small enough dog, will get things flipped back into place again. It's not life-threatening. If it occurs frequently, where it becomes a big issue for the dog, then sometimes we will go in and do a soft palate resection. If it's like too big, a redundant soft palate that's always getting trapped, may consider doing that. But usually we don't have to do anything about it.
All right.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Judy in Duluth, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
You sure can.
I'm Anna Sell. I'm calling about my daughter's lab, and I hope I have enough information to give you a picture. It's a wonderful, healthy lab with a sudden attack of what wouldn't let her walk or even get around. They had to literally carry her into the veterinary office. Now, she's only 5 years old. The standard blood tests initially showed some Lyme and so forth, so they treated her with a heavy-duty antibiotic and the standard thing, but then it turned out not to be the case. Well, she didn't react at all to that. The only thing she reacted to was some steroids that they gave.
Now, I have to ask, is this her front legs and back legs, or just her back legs?
You know, I think when it first manifested, it wasn't necessarily body-wide, but now it's body-wide. She had, after about a week or so, they noticed a big sort of mushy mass on her upper, I think, left haunch, and then she suddenly was not able to even walk. Her legs are mushy, and sometimes they're stiff.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're kind of going with what they assume is a lupus, at least a lupus type.
Weird. Yeah, I mean, we're getting lots of strange calls today,
yeah.
And Again, if there's a mass there, hopefully the veterinarian can biopsy it, either with a needle or something, to find out what that is. I'd be curious to know if the dog is weak or neurologically impaired, and there is a difference between the two. So you can have a dog that's just, I am so weak I can't get up. You can have a dog that doesn't want to get up because they're in pain, and you can have a dog that doesn't want to get up because their nervous system's impaired, whether it be spinal cord abnormality or peripheral nerve weakness. These would be all things would have to be looked at to try to figure out what's going on. And, you know, I don't think you probably have enough information to be able to help me, but it sounds very serious. And, you know, again, if there's an issue where they're stumped, get a second opinion. I mean, she probably needs to be someplace. And remember, Lyme disease usually is asymptomatic for most dogs. And I think it's way overdiagnosed, because when we start checking dogs, we see lots of dogs that have been exposed. Very few dogs ever develop clinical signs of it. And when we do see clinical signs, it's usually two syndromes, usually either joint pain and acute joint pain and fever and joint swelling and so on, or kidney problems. Doesn't sound like that's what's going on with this dog. So I'm sorry I'm not able to help you, but I think those would be all the areas that I'd be wanting to look at, is a good neuro exam, you know, and, you know, also, you know, be evaluating the dog's electrolytes and everything. I mean, so it's a you know, whole host of things to be looking at, and don't think I can do that over the radio.
All right. Stump Dr. Sandy Dean.
Well, I think that if I had the dog and I had the medical records and I had the lab test in front of me,
then you know.
Much different story than just, you know, grandma calling and saying the dog's down. You know, I'm sorry, but that's the problem with getting things secondhand.
Yeah. Wendy and Ladysmith, we'll go to you next. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. You know, you've had a lot of calls with some bad problems.
I'm hoping
I can give some good news to dog and cat owners out there.
Good. Please tell us.
As far as wood ticks and fleas, my dogs never get fleas.
Okay.
I have a shed that they can go in. They're in or out dogs, which they can come and go as they please. Pure cedar chips, they get that scent on them. It'll keep the ticks and the fleas away. And if they do get wet with rain, they smell wonderful. They don't have that nasty dog smell.
Yeah, I wish that could be true. I really wish that could be true. My guess is that, yes, it does. This cedar oils and so on may have some benefit in maybe a little bit of repellency and so on, but none of the research substantiates that.
Really?
And my guess is that either where they like to hang out just isn't tick central. Like, I mean, they're not going out in the fields where there's a lot of, you know, of ticks and so on, because if you truly tested them, I would bet that you would get ticks on your dog. So,
yes, I have run them in the woods, but they have a big backyard fenced off. They can run wherever they want. Yeah. I have pine trees, so I don't know if the ticks hang around there.
Not usually. Usually tall grasses and things like that is their favorite area.
Yeah, and the fleas, I mean, none of my dogs never had fleas.
Yeah, and remember, fleas, they don't do well in dry environments. So if you've got sandy soil, they would probably not do well there.
Mm-hmm.
That you need a source for fleas. They don't just spontaneously appear. They come from usually infected wildlife, like possums and raccoons.
Right.
That hang around, and then they drop the eggs off of the fleas that are living on them, and the eggs turn into larvae and so on and develop into immature fleas that then can hatch. And if the environment isn't right for those early flea stages outside, your dogs are probably never going to be exposed. So here in Madison, we've got like new neighborhoods with short grass. It's sunny, it's dry, it's warm. There's, you know, no shade, not the right substrate for fleas to develop in. People will never see fleas. But it's usually the shaded areas with lots of wildlife that you're going to run into troubles.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sandy, we have some emailers asking about these topical tick remedies. You talked about it earlier, but I know the EPA, Health Canada and the EPA are actually going to look into this issue.
Yeah. I printed off the listing of the EPA registered spot on flea and tick products. That is just the ones that are the spot on products. And there is a 15-page list. Small type. I lost count at about 500. Okay, so there's over 500 different ones that are licensed by the EPA. I think, you know, any time you get an adverse reaction, and when people think adverse reaction, they usually think really serious ones. If it's even just a little skin irritation, that gets reported as well. At least it should get reported. And so there, you know, there's a whole range of adverse reactions that you can see, from mild skin irritations right up to seizures and potentially death. Big concern I always have is making sure that, one, you're using a product that's the right size and, you know, dosage for your pet, and that you're using it on the right species. Dog products may not be used in cats necessarily. Right. So you have to be careful with what you're using, that you're using it at the right dose and that you're applying it to the skin appropriately in a spot where maybe the dog can't lick at it and ingest it and take it in a different way. So those would be all things to be looking at. When it comes to safety of products, probably one of the safest ones out there is Frontline, and yet that's the one that people are having a lot of scrutiny about. And I think it's just because of the number of doses that are being used. Mm-hmm. You can see once in a while some dogs with skin irritation with it, but I have never, in all the years that it's been on the market, seen anything other than that. So, you know, I think the safest ones typically are the ones that your veterinarian's going to recommend. The ones that you buy over the counter, it's consumer beware. And, you know that they have been evaluated and have passed EPA testing. But remember, you are then making a decision regarding the health and dose and safety for your dog. And maybe your veterinarian should be the one that can help you with that better.
All right. Makes sense. Jean and Mercer, your turn now. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have an 11-year-old dog who's recently been diagnosed with diabetes.
Okay.
And I'm wondering about the diet to feed her. The vet said feed her some senior foods, and I looked on the internet and I saw things about high protein, low fat, high fiber.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no real diabetic dog food out there.
Oh, there is, though. There really is.
Oh, I haven't found it.
Well, there's one that Nestle Purina makes, and it's called DCO, Diabetes Colitis Diet. And it's called DCO, and it's a high-fiber diet. And dogs do very well on a high-fiber diet that are being managed with their diabetes. Cats, on the other hand, do better on a low-fiber, high-protein food. And there's one that's called MD for cats that we use. And then there's another one that's called DM that we use as well. That one's actually labeled for diabetes. And that's the one that Nestle Purina makes for cats. But I'd be looking at talking to your veterinarian about the DCO diet by Nestle Purina. I think that would be probably more appropriate than just a senior diet. And if your vet doesn't carry that, they can write you a prescription. And many of the big chain pet stores and so on do carry some of these prescription diets now, and you can pick them up there.
All right.
Oh, great.
Thank you very much for calling. For a lab puppy, how much exercise is too much in its first year?
Oh, you know, they do need exercise, but you just have to be careful that you're not taking them out and pounding them on the pavement with those, you know, nice tender joints. So going to a park and playing in your yard, playing fetch and so on, swimming, all great ways of exercising. But just like racehorses, you're not going to put them out on the track and have them, you know, run. You just have to be smart. Nice walking on the road, but when it comes to running, you know, do it on softer surfaces and you know, dirt rather than pavement.
And one last one, a different lab here. What's an appropriate age for a lab pup to be introduced to invisible fence?
Oh, that's a good one. I usually like to wait until they're past their, what we call their fear period, when they're 6 to 8 months of age or a little bit older. I think that would be an appropriate age.
Well, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here. Sorry I was kind of crabby today. I was frustrated. All these horrible calls, and I feel so bad for these patients, but maybe they can call me at the vet school and we can spend a little more time talking there.
And you're back here on June 9th.
I am.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, with us today, and she will be back again on June 9th. Just a quick look ahead. Tomorrow at 11, University of Missouri ag economist emeritus John Eichert talks about his vision of sustainable capitalism. That's kind of interesting. And then at 11:45, Chuck Law and Nancy Shum-Burgess, author of Wisconsin Barns, will be with us and pay tribute to our state's rural heritage. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.